Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 19, interview with Ken Anderson and Gwen Holdman. This is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that is doubly interesting, dually exciting, and twofold the fun.
Okay. I think it took me 19 shows. I think I got this one.
I made it easy just for you, but there's two reasons for it. Can you get both reasons?
Oh, well, the obvious one is if you know anything about Ken and Gwen, who are we're going to be doing the interview today with, they are, well, should I give out the news? Yeah. Well, they just had twins, and so they were just about ready to have twins that we found out during our interview, and so that's where the doubly
That's the first reason.
And the second one is because they both run dog sleds and both race.
That's true.
That's not it, huh?
Well, it's close.
Okay, it's because they both lived in Minnesota. No.
No, this is a little more obvious than that.
Okay, this is...
You actually introduced the show, and when you introduced the show, you said what?
This is Tim. This is Sled Dog Podcast. This is our second year.
No.
Okay.
No, this is the first interview that we've ever interviewed two people.
Oh, good point.
So not only are we interviewing two people today, we're interviewing both Ken and Gwen, and just to make it doubly fun, it is too the fact that they just had twins, so...
Yes, very exciting, and we're so happy. So congratulations, Ken and Gwen, for your wonderful, darling children, and I'm sure they're just the most beautiful children in all of Alaska right now, at this moment.
Until
somebody else listens. Okay. Hey, so we also have a bunch of other news for you. We want to say thank you to a bunch of email that we've gotten over the last month or so since we've been off the air. And why don't you read off those people?
Okay. We had an email from Darren, who has adopted some Alaskans from the Second Chance League, and he wanted us to put the word out about the Second Chance League, that there are a lot of Alaskans out there that need to be adopted in shelters.
Yeah, it's that time of year, and with the economy and everything going kind of sour in some areas, I think a lot of people are hurting, and so I know there's a lot of dogs in our area that need adopting. So if you get a chance and your heart's big enough, which I'm sure it is, if you can afford it, try to go out there and grab a dog.
Okay, and we also got a letter from Marsha, who is a homeschool mom. Go homeschool moms.
There you go.
Woo-hoo. She had a great suggestion for us, and Marsha, we're looking into it, and hopefully we'll get to take you up on that.
Yes, absolutely. Boy, it's sunny out here. Okay, good.
Hmm.
And also we want to shout out to Matt Hammersley. Thank you, Matt, for helping me out on our links page.
Just
being
cheers.
A great guy. Cheers. There you
Matt's
go.
Matt's from England, so hello everyone from England.
Yes, we love you guys.
We got another email from Linda in Colorado, who's not into dog sledding but is interested into the sport. She's actually into dog confirmation and showing and things
and agility
like that.
And so forth. Yeah, so that's awesome. Cool. And a big shout out to Amanda Bird. Amanda, thank you so much for your email. It was really helpful, kind of got us remotivated. And Amanda is the editor and works with Greg Salatin on Mushing Magazine. And boy, I tell you, if you don't have that magazine, you gotta have it. I mean, every month or every other month when we get it, it is just great. I mean, the articles are wonderful. The colors and the pictures are just incredible. I just don't know how this sport would do it without it. I mean, they've really filled a great niche. So thank you, Amanda, and thank you, Greg, for putting out a wonderful magazine. So, well, this interview was pretty neat. Ken runs, well, you'll hear about all the different races he runs, but they live up in, is it Wolf?
Fox, Alaska.
Fox. I always want to say Wolf.
Yeah.
It's Fox, Alaska, just
north of Fairbanks.
Just north of Fairbanks, and it's
right
a great
off the
story.
Almost.
Yeah, well, they literally are off the grid.
Yeah.
So it's a really neat interview. I think, you know, we hear about a lot of folks living out in the woods and really, you know, running dogs and so forth, but it was fun to be able to talk to Ken and Gwen about really how they do it and how literally they are off the power grid and how they use minimal power and minimal water and minimal everything to sustain life and still be able to train up and run in the Iditarod and multiple races, the Yukon.
The Yukon Quest.
It's just amazing. So I really, my hat goes off to them. It's just amazing. I hope you really enjoy the interview. And as we're doing the interview, we are out of topics with Dr. Tim. and we are looking for more ideas. And Dr. Tim said, you know what, let's hear from the audience. So if everybody could make a note to write a quick letter to tim@sleddogpodcast.com, or...
And if you're concerned about emailing Tim, Gina@sleddogpodcast, and that's G-E-N-A.
Why would they be concerned?
Well, hon, I won't go there.
Hey, I'm not a spammer.
No, that's not what I mean.
Okay.
You know, about getting the whole thing in the beginning, maybe.
Yeah, they're concerned that I'm just not going to get it. Okay. Yeah, we'd love to hear with you any vet questions that you may have.
Anything you can think of, any problems that you've had or any issues that you had that a veterinarian, I guess, could answer that we already haven't answered. Hopefully there's still questions out there because we would like to continue on with Dr. Tim, and we've ran out of our questions, so...
Yeah, we can. You know, he's kind of helped us, and he's fixed us, so now we're out there to fix the world, I guess. So if you've got a question or a vet question about how to maintenance or do take care of dogs or take care of anything or kennel questions or anything, let us know, and we'll pass those questions on, and Dr. Tim will come on and give us the answers. So other than that, we want to say thank you so much for listening. I know we had a small pause there for a couple of months. Kind of took the summer off, and... Well, we traveled. We went up to the UP, we did a lot of things, and we're getting ready for winter again, so everybody gets pretty busy in the summer. And so we want to say welcome back, and thank you for all the wonderful emails asking where we were and how we're doing and so forth. Oh, and more importantly, I want to tell you about a great event that's going on right here in Michigan, in Mansalona, Michigan. It is the Meet and Greet Lance Mackey. It's on September 14th. That's just about a week away. I'm really excited. And Lance is coming to town, and it's at the Last Chance Kennels. Russ and Sherry Sotheby are putting it on. It's fantastic. If you want to go to the website and take a look at it, you can go to www.russ-stickacres.com. That's www.russ-stickacres.com. Or go out to Sled Dog Central and just look up under the seminars, and it's there. It's a great event. It's going to be about a 3-4 hour event. Starts at 1 o'clock and goes until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a small admission charge, but it's definitely going to be worth it to not only meet Lance, but the other folks that are going to be there. So come one, come many, and I hope you can all make it.
Sounds great. We'll be there.
I'm going to be there.
Yeah, I know you're going to be there.
I'm going to be there. I'm excited, so I'm definitely going to be there. So all right. There's all kinds of DVDs and everything else for sale, but please, if you can make it over to it, it's going to be a great event. And you can go out to Sled Dog Central and take a look at that and email them for a quick reservation. You'd be all set. Hey, so let's go to the interview.
Great.
Why don't you start us off, Gwen, and tell us a little bit about your past and how you got to where you're at.
Sure, I can do that. I've always been a real dog lover. As a kid, I had a tendency to pick up stray dogs pretty frequently and bring them home to my parents and try to keep them all. And my parents, you know, I pretty typical Midwest upbringing. You know, we lived in a fairly average sized home, and essentially there's no way they were going to let me keep all these dogs that I constantly brought home. One time it was a litter of 5 puppies that I found on the side of the road or something, and so you know, they made me find homes for them. And the logic was basically, well, if we let you keep all these dogs that you brought home all the time, before you know it, you'd have 20 dogs, and what would you ever do with 20 dogs, you know? And so, you know, I thought that seemed fairly logical until I came up to Alaska on a vacation as a teenager with my family, and I realized that people still mush dogs, that it's not something from another century, and that that dog mushing is a really active and vibrant sport up here. And I decided right then and there that this is what I would do with 20 dogs. I'd be a dog musher because I love the outdoors too. And so that I kind of continued to sort of pursue that concept in my head that I was going to move to Alaska as soon as I possibly could. And I eventually did.
Oh, that is fantastic. And now with that in mind, did you go right out of high school? Did you move up, or when did you move up?
No, I would have liked to have moved up out of high school, but I was fortunate enough to get a full ride scholarship playing tennis, and they don't have a tennis program up here at the university. And I did want to go to college, so I went to college in the lower 48. But I tried to work with mushers during my breaks from school. And I actually picked a musher. Initially, I was hoping to come up to Alaska, but in the end, I wound up working for a musher in northern Minnesota. Arlie Jorgensen, and that's actually where I met Ken. He was working for the same rusher up there, and I had a couple dogs of my own, and I went up there on at least one fairly memorable winter break from school, and helped out Ken and met him and helped out Arlie, and that's really how I started to get into it. And then the day I graduated from college, I moved up to Alaska with just my first few sled dogs that I had already.
Wow, that is fantastic. So Ken, how does your story play out? I know you were from Minnesota, and is it similar, or tell us about you?
I was exposed to dogs at a young age from my parents. Even before I was born, my parents had a recreational team of Alaskan Malamutes, and actually it was like three dogs. They would do winter camping trips, and then they raced them, the three-dog class, actually, in sprint races. And my dad and another guy, this guy named Pat Carnes, were the original ones that got the Grand Rapids, Minnesota sprint race going, which wound up becoming a pretty big race down there in the Midwest. As I was coming along, we were more just doing the winter camping trips up into the Boundary Waters. I just really took to liking that. I really enjoyed those trips. My mother still tells stories of changing my diapers in 30 below out in the Boundary Waters when I was a little kid. One thing led to another, I guess, and I found out about the Iditarod. My dad bought me this book about the Iditarod race, and this just totally caught my fascination, and I kind of made this promise to myself. I didn't really tell anybody else about it. I don't know why, but it was just this personal promise. I said, this is one thing I want to do in my life, is to run the Iditarod. And I wasn't sure what else I wanted to do, but that was just one goal. I absolutely wanted to do it at some point. I didn't even really aspire to win or to make it a lifestyle, but it was something I certainly wanted to do. I got into weight pulling with a golden retriever we had when I was in like later elementary and junior high school, and we also had a couple Malamutes I did that with, and I'd go around to all the weight pulls that were usually at sprint races in Minnesota for a couple years. I'd go around the circuit and bum rides with some of the adults, and my parents would take me to some, and then I kind of drifted away from it a little bit during high school. I was a pretty serious athlete too. I was a wrestler, and into typical high school things, girls and sports and dog mushing. Never left my it was something I still always wanted to do, but it wasn't in the forefront. And after my freshman year of college, I went to Grand Marais up in northern Minnesota and worked for this guy where Glenn and I met, this Arlie guy, and that kind of got me back into things and got the ball rolling again, and worked for him on and off for a couple of years, and then got up to Alaska to volunteer for the 93 Iditarod and met Jeff King, and stayed up here and worked for Jeff for a while. I handled for quite a few different mushers, just kind of wanting to learn all I could from different types of mushers and different styles of dogs and from different styles of racing until I made the big leap and started to get my own dogs. I worked for like Susan Butcher for a bit. I worked for Curtis Earhart, that clan, Curtis and Gareth Wright and Ramey Brooks for a little bit, and commercial fished with Dean Osmar in the summertime, and Dave and Dana Shear, and so I got to see lots of different dogs. And then Gwen and I were together then, and eventually we broke off on our own and started our own kennel.
Sounds great. And what year was that you guys actually took the leap in getting into your own kennel?
That was about 90.
I got into it a little bit before you did with my own dogs, I'd say. Like, basically right when I came to Alaska, I started accumulating dogs. But Ken was a little more hesitant to actually, I think, get his own dogs and start, you know, really taking that responsibility. Because I think he knew that once he did that, he was going to get into it, you know, for a lifetime. And I think he was a little more aware of that and maybe a little hesitant to take that plunge, you know. But Ken, you got your first dog, right? Probably second year that we were up here, or midnight. So.
Yeah, that's right. Gwen came up with a couple cast-offs from Arlie and a couple dogs from the pound, and that wasn't quite how I how I wanted to start things. And my first dog I got from Curtis and Shannon and Ramey and Gareth, and I don't even know who owned the dog. I just gave him a check. And it's kind of silly. I bought my first dog with a student loan.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that kind of tells you where my focus was at the time. I was kind of going to college, and I'd do pretty good actually at in the fall, and then the snow would start to fly, and my focus would just completely change, and my grades would slip a little bit, and I was really into the dogs and running, and started to do some races and trying to kind of be a student at the same time. And I'm not as good of a multitasker as my wife, and she was able to kind of stick with some school. She was actually going to, she was in a PhD program here at UAF and did that for 2 years, I think.
Okay, so while you're handling for everybody then, Ken, were you also racing their dogs, or were you not racing at all, just handling?
Let's see. Oh, yeah, and when I worked for Arlie, kind of the last time I worked for Arlie, I worked for him like 2 summers and then a kind of a winter and a half while I was going to school in Minnesota. But the last winter there, I did, when Gwen and I met, I was training his team for the Bear Grease, and he was going to race it, and it was kind of a long story, but I wound up racing the team, actually, and I didn't do very good. I actually got sick the first night. I got, Giardia or Campylobacter or something real nasty and wound up in the hospital. So that was my first experience in the racing. It was not so good. I take that back. I worked for Bob Summers, too, a little bit. One of the first winters I spent in Grand Marais, I was working for Arlie, and then I worked for this guy, Bob Summers, handling. I went with him to Montana to handle at the Race to the Sky, and stayed with him for like a month or so. And he let me race a team in the, I can't remember the race. It was up by like Orr in Minnesota. I can't remember the race. That was my first actual race. I think the Bear Grease was my second one. But,
those are tremendous races to be your first race. That just is amazing. You didn't do like a little 10-mile, a little 5-mile.
No. Then when I was working for Curtis and Ramey, they did actually. That was the first winter when I and I was up here. They were really helpful. Gave us a great opportunity. They lent us, just forked over like about, I don't know, 12 yearlings and 2-year-olds that weren't quite good enough to make their main team for either Ramey running distance or Curtis doing sprint. And just said, here, take these dogs. Here's all the food. Here's a sled. Here's some gear. And just run them as much as you can and race them as much as you want and do whatever you want with them. But get them out, get them exercise, keep them going. And so that winter I did a bunch of races here locally. It was a lot of fun. I ran like the Limited North American with them, and then I did the Nenana comeback race. I did the Two Rivers 90, a couple other. I think I did the Tripod Classic race down in Nenana, and just had a blast with those dogs. And we didn't have a dog truck. We drove them around in the car. It was pretty bad. We'd pull up to races at the track and squeeze in between these very nice, big, fancy rigs and open the door, and all the dogs would pile out, and we'd pull a line out and string it around the tires. And it was pretty bad.
Oh, that's classic.
Now, Gwen, how about you? When you were handling, or as soon as you got to Alaska, did you just start racing?
No, when I was handling for Arlie, I was kind of like the bottom of the pecking order there. I was pretty much the poop scooper, you know.
Right.
But I was learning then. But But yeah, when, like Ken said, when we started handling up in Alaska together for the most part, and so when we had those dogs from Curtis and Ramey, I ran some races as well. There was my first race was a 40-mile race called the Bison 40 down in Delta. It doesn't exist anymore, but you know, just kind of getting out there and running the dogs, and you know, it was a really great experience to have that opportunity to get some really pretty nice dogs, and that really kind of became the beginning for us in terms of our breeding program and things like that too.
So your very first race, honestly, your very first race on a sled was 40 miles?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow.
That's awesome. That was awesome.
I wouldn't say that it wasn't without some adventures, but yeah. Yeah.
Still, that's amazing.
At that time, I was really focused on, I was more interested in long distance racing. And for some reason, Ken initially was more interested in sprint and stage racing. My goal coming up here was really right off the bat to run the Yukon Quest. That was my focus. And Ken actually, so I started, you know, running fairly early on. I ran the Copper Basin and some longer distance or mid-distance races, and Ken focused more on sprint and stage, which worked out, you know, pretty well for both of us. So we had a little bit of a different focus.
Well, you know, let's shift over to that. How is it? Because you both love to race and you both race. How is it? Is there a competition between the two of you? Or is it just fun to compete with each other in these races? And how many races have you guys run together?
We compete against each other, that's for sure. it's fun. Especially a lot of times in the stage races, you know, where our interests kind of converge, I'd say. You know, we try to set up the teams where you have an A and a B team, maybe, but sometimes it doesn't wind up working out that way. Maybe a couple key dogs really peak and winds up maybe getting a little closer than we anticipated. Ken has a good story from racing down in Oregon at the Attaboy 300. I don't know if you want to tell that, Ken.
Oh, that'd be great. Ken, tell us about that story.
Well, yeah, I we were both racing the Attaboy, and she had the A team, and I had the B team, and we never actually, I think for like relationship harmony, we never really structured like two even teams. I don't know if we wanted to know who was the better racer, but we were pretty competitive, and she didn't have a very good race, and I had a really, really good race, and so it was just kind of the way it worked in that race, and I almost beat her with the B team. It was on the last day, and the trail came right by this trailhead where we had been training, and I thought we were going to have trouble there because the dogs, I figured, would want to turn in their left, and sure enough, my one leader, I don't know, she was kind of actually Gwen's favorite dog, but somehow I wound up racing her. We didn't think she was quite good enough for the A team, but she was my leader, and I don't know if Gwen and her had some sort of telepathy going on or what, but that leader just ducked in down and tried to go back to where the trucks used to be, but the finish line was the other way, and I struggled there for a few minutes, and Gwen wound up beating me by just like a minute or two, something like that.
Oh, that is great. That is great.
So I'm kind of curious how we decide who gets A and B. I mean, do you draw straws? What is it?
Does the other one have to do dishes? What's the scoop?
Well, I think we've kind of decided that Ken's focus has been more on the Iditarod. I think he's a better long-distance musher than I am. And so, for a few years there, we were kind of had a arrangement where I would get to run the main team and the stage races, and that would be sort of my focus, especially since I've always worked full-time. And Ken's, had the opportunity to be a little more focused on doing the dog mushing full-time, so getting to do the longer training runs and things like that. So he'd run the Iditarod then, and that worked out pretty well for a few years there, kind of the way we set it up.
Ken, what switched for you to make, you know, to make the move from the sprint and the stage to say you wanted to go long distance?
Well, I don't, you know, it's kind of weird how I sort of evolved into this sprint and stage. I mean, my goal is, as a kid and everything, and in the back of my mind is, and I don't even know, in the back of my mind and the forefront really has been to do the Iditarod and be successful. But I think you're really influenced by the first person you handle for, you know, and this guy Arlie was really had lots of great stories from racing in the northern Canadian provinces, these 10-dock mass start races and up in Yellowknife and the Paw and all these faraway villages. And somehow that kind of stuck in my head, and it was kind of a type of racing that I wanted to do there for a while. But, I mean, the goal was always to try to be successful at Iditarod. And I first ran Iditarod in 99. Glenn ran the Quest in 98. But I was doing, yeah, just switching all around, doing sprint and stage and middle distance. And I think, I mean, for a while there, it was kind of, it seemed like sort of this financial catch-22 we were in, because, you know, we're always sort of struggling for money, and we had some success down in the stage races, like in Wyoming and Oregon, and for a while there, you know, they had the two races back-to-back. You could drive down there before gas was super expensive and do both races back-to-back. There's good money. We'd almost always field two teams in both races. The Wyoming race had this musher support program where one year we won like 19 tons of dog food through this musher support program. And,
wow.
You know, it was the year we won Wyoming, between Oregon and Wyoming, I think we won like almost $50,000 in cash plus that dog food, the value of that. And it was always kind of like we needed to win money at these preliminary races just to get to Iditarod, you know?
Right. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, in hindsight, maybe we sort of did things backwards. Maybe I should have just focused on just doing well in Iditarod and doing well in the local mid-distance races up here. But I was good at stage racing, and I wasn't quite so successful in the middle distance races. I didn't feel as confident that I could win money in races like, say, the Copper Basin, the Kinnick 200. Well, there's not much money in that race, but like the Cusco, I didn't feel like it was as sure a bet as going down to Wyoming. We always seemed to do pretty good there and come back with some money. But the thing was, is we were always all year long, all fall and early winter, we were training for the stage races. We'd never do runs longer than about 6 hours or so, and only one or two of those. And so we were running at a higher RPM, really gearing up for the stage races. And then the Iditarod was just sort of this like afterthought, you know. We would get done with Wyoming and drive north as fast as we could. We'd have to work on food drops for about a week. And while I was doing food drops, I was trying to do a couple camping trips with the dogs. And then it was time to go down to Anchorage for Iditarod. And so I never really got the long miles on the dogs. I never really got good, you know, what I consider now like good distance training on the dogs. And so I always had a fast team, but I had to have to rest. It seems like I'd have a lot of injuries in the early Iditarods and want to finish with six or seven dogs, and probably because we were running at a faster RPM, you know, in hindsight. But so just this last, I'm giving you the long version here.
Okay.
It seems like we finally, you know, accepted that, hey, you know, if we're going to make it here, we need to be successful at Iditarod. That's where the sponsors are. Not that we have a lot of sponsors or anything, but that's where, for the long-term solvency of the kennel, it seems like, and it's always been my goal anyways, that we need to just kind of settle down and focus on the Iditarod and being successful with that. And I guess that's been the main focus these last let's see, these last 2 years. In 06 was the last year we did stage racing. We went to France and then went to Wyoming. And in 07, and then last year, I just totally focused on distance. And the I think the results show, you know, I was seventh, and
absolutely.
I did a rod in 07. And then last year, we had a really good year. And this year, we plan on staying in Alaska again and doing, and I'm getting a little more confident and with the middle distance races too. I feel like, you know, chances are good I can win some money locally in these mid distance races. Now I've run enough of them where I have a better feel for how to race them. And so I think I kind of feel like this, the stage races and traveling to Canada and that, like we always did, is maybe going to be a thing of the past. But that's okay. We did it and had some great experiences racing over there in those mass start races. And I went to Yellowknife. We went there about, I don't know, 5-6 times. And that's an awesome race, lots of history. And so,
You bring something up, and I guess it's the first time that we've ever thought about, or I've ever thought about it during this time. And it seemed pretty apparent when you were just talking about how both of you got into this because of the love of the sport and the love of the dogs and so forth. And then you're kind of forced into winning to support the kennel. So, I mean, I don't want to say forced into winning, but the winning is obviously not simply for the money. It's for because you've got the competitive spirit and you want to win. But if you don't win, then you can't support the kennel. It's like it's almost a paradigm there, isn't it? Or a pendulum there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's to race successfully, you got to spend so much time training the dogs, and it's basically a full-time job. I mean, we don't have another outside income that's big enough where I can hire a whole entourage of handlers to do all the work, and then I just jump on this, you know, I have a different job or something, jump on the run. And I don't really want to do it that way. And so far it's working out okay.
How many dogs do you guys have?
Sorry about that. about
the hardest question of the day.
I think we have 20 puppies this year. We bred three females and they had big litters, all three of them. And we didn't really want that many puppies, but, we have, let's see, 19 puppies. And then there's about 20 yearlings, and I'm training right now 33, I think, adult dogs that are 2 years and older, and then we've got about 15 retirees. So I don't know, it's pushing 85, something like that.
That is fantastic. Now, when you guys were you're sitting there, and you have kind of a unique lifestyle. Tell us a little bit about your house and where you guys live and so forth.
Gwen, you want to take that one?
Yeah, she's like, oh no, I have to take this one. Well, Gwen, I really think about that because you said you had a full time job and you go off to a full time job, and I was just really curious about this.
Oh well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of, we're just really fortunate in sort of the time I think that we're living in. You know, with we don't have any electricity where we live. We're a ways north of Fairbanks, not too far, about 35-minute drive or so from town, and we're in a really fantastic spot in terms for mushing and really great fabulous trails and views and stuff like that, but we're off the power grid and we don't have running water or anything like that. And so but still, you know, I'm an engineer. I'm running a program right now, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska, but I can work at home. Like, you know, this morning I've been on the internet trying to get a few things done before this interview. And so, you know, we're pretty fortunate in the time that we live in. And then also, you know, we have solar panels here at our house. We're talking about maybe getting a wind generator too. We have a pretty small footprint, a small house that we live in, and we heat with wood. And so, you know, I really enjoyed that part of our lifestyle too. It's just being somewhat self-sufficient. We have a couple of vehicles that run off of waste vegetable oil. We're not always very good, at least lately, about actually getting the waste vegetable oil. Sometimes we just run regular diesel in them. But it's still, we're thinking about how to reduce our energy consumption in our life. And I really think that it's a pretty valuable thing that, in terms of just, self-fulfillment for me, it's kind of interesting.
Gwen, when I saw your webpage,
but it's cheaper too.
Oh yeah, I imagine that except for the dog food, but that's a whole other thing. But when I saw your webpage, I thought, wow, that is just such a fantastic thing. How does, I guess, how do you manage that? Like the internet and so forth. Is it through cell phone? And then also, how did you become, or how did you get into that versus your lifestyle with the dogs and everything else?
Yeah, that's a good question because, these dogs are expensive. We've kind of touched on that this morning. And when I first moved up to Alaska, Ken and I actually moved up permanently a little bit before Ken did. And I wound up in a squatter's cabin, just this cabin that kind of an abandoned cabin off one, a main road, that I guess somebody probably owned, but I don't know who it was. And so I moved back there. So it was basically free. It was a really great experience, but it was definitely off the power grid. I mean, it was like from another century, basically, and that kind of was the first time where, me having grown up in a very traditional middle class, Midwestern home, as I mentioned earlier, really had to think about, how much water do I use in my daily life or how much energy do I actually need? I mean, I didn't have any electricity there. It wasn't an option. I had a propane light, and suddenly you're not taking for granted that there's just an electric plug there that you can plug in, your appliances and you're good to go. You start thinking about, where is my power coming from? Where's my water coming from? And do I really need that much when I have to haul it, a half a mile back to my cabin if I'm going to have drinking water and things like that? Or for the dogs, I hauled water from a creek there. And so that really got me thinking more and more about energy and how we use it and how maybe we can conserve more and what our alternatives are in the future. And, if, in terms of where we live up here, it's really not rocket science at all. We happen to be up a pretty high on a hill, and so we've got a pretty good line of sight, and it's just a wireless Wi-Fi connection that goes off of that's on one of the local providers in town here. So, that works out really great. And with cell phones, today, cell phones and having that internet connection, I mean, I could be working anywhere in the world and have this, and it's just really ideal for us.
That is fantastic. And, I guess it sounds like you're pretty passionate about that, which is awesome. And I think it's, as we're sitting here in our little studio, we call it, otherwise known as the basement, and we're looking at all the different things that we plug in, I'm sitting here thinking, gosh, it would be so interesting to be able to try to do that. I don't know if I could do it, but it would definitely be an interesting try. Is it something that's doable to folks if they, I guess I look at it and say, can mushers do it? Obviously they can. And do you think that influences the way you not only train, but also the way you guys win the races?
I think it's kind of cool because, Ken and I have never had the luxury of having a lot of extra money. And in some ways, I feel like that's actually been a real, almost an advantage, even though it seems really frustrating at times. But, for Ken, going out there and doing that last training run, it's never really, there's not an option to it because, again, it is this catch-22. We've really got to make some money in these races or else, we're really going to struggle to stay in the sport at all. And so, and the same thing for me with energy, we couldn't afford to live someplace where we had traditional power or real, house. Our cabin's pretty small. It's only 14 by 16, two-story. So just two really small rooms. And we're building a bigger place right now, but this has been really adequate for just the two of us. We're expecting twins now, so we feel like we need a little bit of a bigger place. But I think it's actually an opportunity. It's like a challenge because you don't have the money, so you wind up living way out of town and not having electricity because no one else wants to live out here. but then it gives you this opportunity to really do some really cool things that I think that our society needs to start thinking in that direction anyway. So I feel like it's a great opportunity.
Wow. And so we have to just ask when the twins are due.
Well, actually, it looks like they're going to be coming tomorrow. They're overdue, and so my doctor's kind of talked me into probably doing an induction tomorrow. So
you were not kidding. We're sitting here going, oh, that was cute, tomorrow. Like, that's how every pregnant woman always feels, but you actually mean
really,
tomorrow.
No, they're really going to induce tomorrow. Oh.
That is fantastic. Well, I guess your
passions
might change.
You're not really even, like, huffing and puffing. You must be in great shape.
I don't know about that. I'm pretty sick.
That is absolutely wonderful. So, okay, so can we do another interview with a year from now to see how life might change? We'll see if anything...
Yeah, that could be pretty interesting.
Oh, that is great. Well, thinking about, I guess, shifting gears a little bit to the races and the different races, what's your favorite races, both of you? Which ones do you like to run individually or together, or what do you like to run the best?
Well, for a while, I would say Yellowknife was my favorite race. I haven't been there. I guess I raced there last in 2001. Gwen raced in 2003, but it's a long drive. It's an epic just getting there. It's about 2,000 miles one way, and on the Alaska Highway, and then you get to Fort Nelson. I usually stay with the Streepers, and then take off north from there. It's about 500 miles on gravel road north of there. The last little bit coming into Yellowknife is pavement, but I really love that race, just getting there, all the tradition behind it. It was a wild, exciting race, a mass start, and, you know, one of these races where there's some guy up there in a trapper regalia and a black powder rifle, and kawam, the gun goes off, and it's dogs are barking so loud you can't even hear the gun. You just got to look for the shot of black powder, you know. And then teams take off, and it's 50 miles out on Great Slave Lake, and can be windy and nasty out there, and it's a neat race where sprinters and distance guys could come together on this common field. It's getting faster and faster every year, but that was really a fun race, and they had good money, and so, and I don't know, I just always seemed to do well there. I'd get pumped up and do really good. And then we were in Wyoming there for a while, and we really enjoyed the stage races. The camaraderie with the mushers is really good. You spend... Well, we were doing both races. We'd be down there for over a month, you know, and most of the time at the races, we just got all kinds of, met all kinds of other mushers and made lots of friends. We'll be traveling on the road. We'd hardly ever stay in a hotel at all. I mean, we'd be gone from Fairbanks sometimes like 2 months, and I'll bet we've stayed in hotel rooms maybe 3 or 4 nights the whole time. But now, Iditarod is definitely the focus. But I ran the Quest last year, and boy, I'd be easy to fall in love with that race. That's a really neat race. Lots of history there too. Run through some beautiful country. Has a definite different feel about it. Less teams. The mushers are, I think it's a little more hospitable to the mushers along the at the checkpoints and the cabins and such along the way. I'm not sure what currently my favorite race is. I mean, nothing beats the excitement of the Iditarod, that's for sure.
All right, Gwen, your favorite race?
Well, I have to say, I'd probably give a long answer like Ken too, and that the village races, like, not even necessarily Yellowknife. I mean, Ken talked about that one, but we've gone and raced up on the Mackenzie River Delta and out in western Alaska, like Shishmaref and some of those areas. I've really, really enjoyed going to these communities and the hospitality that we've really received in a lot of these, like, fairly small, remote towns, like traveling up to Tuktoyaktuk on the on the Arctic Ocean, you know, and running a race there or something like that, and staying with local family. And you know, that's just been such a really amazing kind of cultural experience for us too. And I've always just been so impressed with how much hospitality and how great the people are when we go and visit those types of places. So I've really enjoyed that. Going over and racing in France was a really neat experience because we had always wanted to race in the Alpenrad. That had been kind of a dream of both mine and Ken's. That was a race we were both interested in, but it actually ended. That last year, the Alpenrad was really the first year we started getting into dogs. We were always pretty disappointed that we never had the chance to go over there and race the Alpenrad. So, and that was a crazy race. Racing in the Alps like that is completely new experience, where you're basically worrying about making it out of each day without breaking a bone or something, or getting a concussion, pretty literally. So, that was pretty cool. I think all these different races have something different to offer, but I especially enjoyed the opportunity to travel, you know, with our dogs and see different places that I might not have felt as much part of. You know, if you couldn't show up in Tuktoyaktuk in the middle of the spring just as a tourist, it'd be kind of awkward maybe, you know, but if you have a dog team, then everyone wants to hear about your dogs and see your dogs and really kind of have a different experience, I think.
That's great. And you mentioned France a couple times. Is that race the Le Grand Odyssey? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, the Grand Odyssey. Yeah, we both ran a team in that a couple of years ago.
Okay. Yeah, we've talked with Dr. Tim Hunt about that a couple of times, and I'm thinking, yeah, I'd love to go there. However, no thanks.
Why?
Yeah.
Because he said it was, I think,
hard.
Very difficult, life-threatening.
Well, the big thing for us, it goes back again to the financial consideration. Unfortunately, because we actually would have liked to have gone back there, but the problem is that we couldn't really afford to do the trip unless we at least both finished the race, you know. And in most races, that's not really a concern. I mean, it's been a pretty rare that one of us has ever scratched in a race, you know. But you know, over there, there's just so many variables that are more challenging to control. You know, we both felt actually pretty darn lucky to make it out of the race without a major accident or you know, both finishing in the top five and all that. We felt like we were pretty fortunate to do that, and that was not a guarantee in any way by going over there. So unfortunately we haven't gone back, but it'd be, you know, we like to, when we travel like that, we like to go together. You know, we prefer to both get the opportunity to race and bring all our dogs, because if you leave, you know, a team at home, then they're getting different training and stuff like that. So,
is it difficult to be at a race where one is racing and one is not? Like, for instance, did you race this past winter, Gwen, being pregnant, or?
No, I actually didn't run a single race this last winter, which was because I've basically been pregnant the entire race season, and you know, that's been a little bit of a different thing for me. It's a little tough not to be as involved in training and racing for me right now, but at the same time, we've been wanting to start a family for quite a while, so we're really excited to do that. And I'm also doing a lot with my career right now too, so you just can't do everything. And you know, I trained, you know, pups this spring, and that was really you know, and helping Ken out, of course, in whatever way I can, but I mean, we're both totally committed to this lifestyle, but still, it's hard not to be really involved on a day-to-day basis for me.
Yeah, well, size has an issue as well. Not bending down as easily, and
you have to understand.
We are in different seasons as women, and we need to sometimes take a different way. So,
right,
that is great.
And then the year before, Gwen, did you? I don't think you raced the year before. She was sick. She had this weird autoimmune condition. We weren't sure exactly what was going on, and the doctors had her on some prednisone, and they said no racing, no mushing, no you know, real physical sports like that. So Gwen's kind of been off the runners here for a little bit. Hopefully she can do some races this year. We'll see how it all goes. We're going into uncharted territory.
For sure. Imagine. And you're going double into uncharted.
Well, Ken, you can stay home and watch the kids, and then she can do the UConn or something. You know, it'll be fun.
I'm curious if you could switch gears again about the UConn Quest. Are you thinking of doing that double back again, or how did you feel doing that this year? You obviously did very well in both the Iditarod and UConn Quest, so I imagine you're going back, but I'm just kind of curious about it.
Well, I'm not sure. I had mixed feelings about doing that. I enjoyed it. I really liked the Quest, and I'd like to do the Quest if I can, but again, you know, being new parents, we're not sure how this is all going to work, how much time we're going to have. We certainly are very dedicated to keeping our mushing lifestyle going, but I guess I felt like what happened last year with the Quest is I finished with 8 dogs. I took 6 of those finishers to my on my Iditarod team, and those 6 dogs are really kind of my best dogs. I mean, overall, like the best dogs in the kennel, and they were pretty flat for most of the race. They wound up doing good right at the end, but for 2/3 to 3/4 of the race, they didn't do much at all until the rest of the dogs kind of slowed down to their RPM. So my best dogs really were dogs that I had either dropped earlier in the Quest, or our old handler, Julie Esty, she's the former Quest director. She resigned from her job as executive director of the Quest to run the Quest, and she had several of our dogs as well, kind of our B team, I guess you'd say, at the time. And she got hurt. She screwed her knee up and wound up scratching in Slavin's cabin early in the race. And so those dogs that were in on her team that also ran the Iditarod with me, they were kind of my best dogs because they weren't really that stressed out on the Quest. And our focus really is, you know, to try to win the Iditarod, and we need to do everything we can to set ourselves up as best we can for that. And I'm not sure, I'm not sure exactly how Lance does it. I never seem to get a straight story as far as which dogs ran the Quest and which dogs ran the Iditarod. You ask him, he'll say one thing. You ask Tanya, she'll say another.
Right.
It certainly can be done. Lance has proven that, but I would think, I know he struggled last year. You know, I don't think he had the best team. He would probably agree with that. Jeff King really had the dominant team, and it's just outmaneuvered him. And Lance, I talked to him in Nome, and he had trouble with leaders, and the dogs were flat and kind of sour. And you know, maybe that was because we raced so hard together. I don't know. The year before, when he won Iditarod, you know, he was basically uncontested in the Quest. He won by like 6 hours or something, and was able to kind of back the throttle off there at the end, and that maybe set him up better for the Iditarod. His team maybe had a little left in the tank, you know.
You know, you sit here and you think, all the dynamics of the dogs, the mushers, the time of the year, life, everything goes on, you know, the food, I mean, everything plays in part of it. It all kind of comes together on the race day, doesn't it? It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big gamble. No, you put all this effort into this one race, and it's exciting, but it's a little dangerous. It's probably not that fiscally responsible.
Yes. When you think about that, because you're basing everything on, you know, the one big race, especially this year and stuff, you know, a million things can go wrong. What's going to happen as far as, you know, if it does go well, let's not even go there. Yep. Let's just be positive. Okay, so this year when you're going to be heading up and you're going to be heading off with these folks in the Iditarod, any big plans, any secret strategies that you want to share with us?
Well, they wouldn't be secret then, would they?
Yeah, I know.
Actually, you know, I have a much clearer picture in my head of the strategy. This year I was, you know, racing up towards the right at the front, while not in first or second, but right up there towards the front, and I learned a lot more. And I learned a lot doing both races back-to-back, and I have some, I think for the first time, some much clearer goals of what I want to do in the Iditarod and how I want to do it and how I want to, what I have to do, like, even now, you know. We started training about 3 weeks ago, and I even feel like I have a pretty sound strategy or set strategy already in my head. And boy, I'm notorious for winging things as I go on the Iditarod, and the night before the race, trying to scratch out a run rest schedule and that kind of a thing, and just going by the seat of my pants. But I feel like I have a goal in the race, what I want to do, based on a lot of thinking of strategy and such. But it's probably going to incorporate long runs, and we're going to have to do a lot of heavy conditioning this year to do that.
That's fantastic. And now, how do you condition in the summertime? Do you have carts, or what do you use? You know, ATVs, quads.
You know, I've done different things. We've over the years done all different kinds of things. We worked on the glaciers for, you probably heard of these summer glacier tour operators. We did that for 3 years, and the dog stayed active doing that. And we've done a lot of loose running over the years. I've been super swamped trying to build this new house, and I really haven't done much with the dogs this summer. But, you know, I didn't do much with them last summer either, to tell you the truth. They just pretty much had most of the summer off. I did a few loose runs here and there. It's pretty scattered. So I'm not really convinced that there's one way to do it, you know. I mean, Lance is my neighbor. He doesn't do anything in the summer with the dogs. He doesn't do any loose stuff. And then you've got Jeff on the opposite extreme, doing all the swimming and that all summer long. And lots of other mushers had their dogs up on the glacier. And I've just seen success doing it both ways. So it's more of an act of necessity, you know. I just simply don't have time to do anything this summer with the dogs. And I feel fine with that. I really don't feel like that's going to handicap us at all, because races are a long time away from now. And we'll have plenty of time, especially since I started so early this year, to get the dogs in really good shape for the Iditarod.
So what is getting them in shape look like now, this time of year? What is it, August 26th?
Oh, well, the afternoons are really too hot to be running the dogs. So I've been running them in the mornings, sometimes late at night. But, yeah, we use a four-wheeler, and just hook them up. We started doing like a five-mile run, and I did that for six or so times, and then jumped to 9 miles, and I've done that six or seven times with each dog. And we run about every other day. Each dog runs about every other day, and I'm now going to jump up to like 13-mile runs.
That is fantastic. And is there, you know, obviously we hear about, obviously the dogs are your life. You've got a house. You've got children on the way. And you've got, Gwen's got a full-time job. Do you guys have any time for anything else? What else do you guys do for fun? Or do you get to relax or have any downtime at all?
We don't have a lot of downtime. And we just bought a TV here for the first time. I guess years ago we had a TV, and we watch movies maybe less than 10 times a year. We bought a TV though for the Olympics. We're old jocks, and so we really enjoy watching the Olympics. So at night there, we would watch the Olympics. And I give the slideshow at a local hotel 5 nights a week. So I go into town 5 nights a week to do that show. And I get home pretty late, like 10:30 or so, and then I got to feed the dogs.
Wait a second. What's a slideshow? What do you mean?
Well, it's a show I give to tourists. It's a slideshow. It's photos that I took, some that the Iditarod's photographer took. I play a video during it, and it's basically the biggest hotel there in town, the Wedgewood. They're a little bit off the beaten path, and their guests were complaining there's nothing to do there. they're kind of locked in there, and so they've hired me to come in, and basically I'm guest entertainment for the guests at night, and it's a free show. The Wedgwood pays me, and then their guests don't have to pay anything, and I sell little things. I like kennel hats and calendars, and then I write a journal every year. I keep a voice recorder with me during the race, during the Iditarod, and I sit down afterwards and write a journal. This last one was about 80 pages long. It's basically a book, and I sell that, and yeah.
That is fantastic. And I noticed that on your website, and it's windycreekkennel.com, you've got your blogs and your journals on the website also, correct? Or some information on the website?
Yeah, I think there's blogs on there. My mom kind of keeps, I write these journal updates every now and then just throughout the season, and I email them to my mom and she sends them off. I'm not sure if they get put up on the blog or not, but Gwen does that during the race. She puts these blog entries up. She gives the kind of the color commentary from the sidelines during the Iditarod. And then you can purchase my journal off the website. The journal is not there, you know, like for free. It was quite an effort to put that together. So we have to charge for that. And it's a sure. fundraiser for the kennel, but
sure.
That's wonderful. Absolutely. And, is writing a passion of yours, or is it just something on the side that you like to do?
I don't know. It's Gwen and I joke that I'm illiterate because I never read. So she's surprised that I actually like to write, you know.
I'm just surprised that you're such a good writer. You know,
you can write.
He's actually doesn't just write, but he's actually a really engaging writer. You know, the journal gets really good feedback too. He's just really good insight into what it takes to be a competitive musher in the Iditarod. And I don't know where he gets those skills from, since I've never seen him basically pick up a book.
That's great.
Yep.
Yeah, well, I think the story of our lives, Ken. So not gonna, you know, don't worry about it. If you can tell,
he's
I do
not
a podcast.
Big reader either.
We do a podcast. I don't do a blog. If you notice, so it's same kind of idea.
Actually, I call Tim his best friend is really his iPod, because he does read, but he literally listens to books. You know, while he's doing chores or out on the tractor or what have you, he's got his little friend with him, the iPod. So, yeah, but awesome. It has brought. Literature into his life, so I'm thankful for the iPod.
But I still don't write as well as Ken does, so that's good.
But he doesn't write, and his handwriting's horrible, so
not gonna happen. Well, this has been fantastic. So you've got big plans for the year. I guess, Gwen, are you going to publish or let us know? How is the world going to know if you had, you know, the twins and how everything goes and that kind of stuff?
Right. Like Ken said, or you guys mentioned, you know, we do have a blog on the website, so we try to keep that updated, and I think we'll have some information on there.
Fantastic.
Great.
So,
I'm sure everybody will be excited. Do you know what you're having already?
It's a boy and a girl.
How awesome.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's perfect. So we've instant family, really.
So, you know, it's going to be 2026, right? We'll be the first.
2026?
Yeah, that'll be the first year they get to run the Iditarod.
Oh! Well, that'll be interesting. I don't know if we necessarily want our kids getting into dog mushing. We've talked a lot about, you know, what the ideal way to bring up kids with our lifestyle is. And Ken's kind of going to be a semi-stay-at-home dad, and I'm going to keep on working. But it's going to be a difference for us and a new adventure. But we kind of feel like... hopefully we can step up to the plate and make it work.
That'll be wonderful. I think they'll love it.
Is there anything else you guys want to share with us? Any passions or anything that you'd like to promote, put forth?
Well, it's funny. We were just watching a sailing, but we also kind of a little hobby of ours that we haven't done it a lot, but is sailing and talking about raising kids and that. One of our goals is to do some big sailing trips with the kids, like in the summer. Gwen's read all these books about people doing long voyages with younger kids. Not, you know, when they're real young, but when they're like 10 or so.
Sure.
And that's something I could foresee us doing down the road in the future.
Oh, absolutely. That's exciting. How about you, Gwen? Anything, any other passion you'd like to talk about? Just get these babies out.
Yeah, right. We've got to evict these guys. No, not really. I mean, I feel like we're just really, really fortunate to be kind of following our dreams, really. And the fact that, you know, we're both into dog mushing and that we're both really committed to making that happen, like even with having, you know, children now, we're both a little bit worried about how that's going to fit into our lifestyle, of course, you know. But I think that we can make it work because we're just both really committed to continuing to mush dogs and to continuing to have a racing kennel. So I think that we're both just really fortunate to have the life that we do, and we wouldn't trade it for anything, I think.
That is awesome. But Ken, I got to tell you, she's going from the relatively smaller house, right? It was a 16 by 20, I think you said, and no power, to a boat or a sailing boat. I'm thinking it's getting smaller each time. I don't know what it's gonna be like, you know, in the future, but that is absolutely fantastic. And we thank you so much for letting us interview you. And the website is Windy Creek Kennels. By the way, where did Windy Creek come in? Is that the area you're in, or just the name?
That's the name of the cabin that I moved into, that squatter's cabin. It was on Windy Creek, and so it was just kind of locally known as the Windy Creek Cabin. And so I picked that name for the kennel, for my kennel originally, when I came up to Alaska, and we've just kind of kept that with us because Ken eventually lived there too, and that place has a lot of really good memories for us, so...
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, thank you so much for everything today.
All right. Thanks for having us.
Wow. What a great interview, huh, Gene?
That went by really quick.
It was long, but it was quick.
Almost to an hour, and I thought, wow.
Yeah.
That didn't even seem like we were talking to him for an hour. It was a great conversation.
Yeah. It's you know, the dynamics between the two of them, how, you know, you and I are competitive, but you're definitely more competitive than I am. But to see how two long-distance mushers would handle having, you know, two teams and still racing, and who gets the A team, who gets the B team, that's all exciting stuff to kind of think about.
Yeah.
Plus the whole idea of how they have to provide the income in order to support the kennels. You know, I tell you, that's a whole new world, I think, with our interview with Buddy and Lance and, you know, everybody, Didi, everybody has to do that same thing. Everybody's kind of always striving to make enough money to support the kennel or try new things or pick up new dogs or whatever it is. So very exciting interview. Thank you so much. And we are so excited about their new children. They were born. We called Ken today to make sure. And yes, they came out just absolutely wonderful. He said they're the most beautiful children. And of course they are. And they have one boy and one girl. And the boy's name is
Leaf.
And the girl's name is
Murray.
Yeah. So congratulations, Leaf and Murray. Welcome to the world.
Yep.
And Alaska. So it's all fun stuff. Don't forget, if you have any questions at all, you can email us at tim@sleddogpodcast.com or
gina@sleddogpodcast.com, and that's G-E-N-A.
And we'll have links to not only Ken's page at windycreekkennel.com, that's windycreekkennel.com. We talked a little bit about it in the interview. On the webpage, we'll have links on our page for his webpage and also for the Mansalona meet and greet with Lance.
Yeah, which is coming up real soon. So,
and don't forget, if you haven't had a chance to go out and get it, there's the book by
Nettie Hall.
It's just the more people I talk to that have picked up that book just absolutely love it. So we've enjoyed it, and I know a lot of people have enjoyed it. So you can go out to Sled Dog Central and find Nettie's information, but please do go out and get a copy of that book. It's going to be supporting Nettie, but more importantly, it's just it's another great mushing-based book. I think you'll really enjoy it. Hey, and here's the interview with Dr. Tim. Dr. Tim, talk to us a little bit about distance versus sprint, and what should we do?
I get this question quite a bit from people. You know, what's more fun to do, sprint or distance? And I'm primarily a distance guy, and I've done a few sprint races, and they're fun. I like a lot of time with my dogs. But what it really boils down to is how much time do we have to devote to adequately training our dog teams up. And if we're a busy family with everybody having jobs and you only have the evenings to work, maybe sprint might be the better way, in that you can train a dog team up for that much quicker and a lot less time put into it than you could a distance. type scenario. So you got to consider what life is putting forth on your table as to how much time you can put into your kennel. And if you have a busy schedule, otherwise sprint mushing, often, you know, an 8-mile course, you're going to be done with it in a pretty short order, 30 minutes or less, plus your hookup time might be an hour. Maybe that's the thing one needs to consider versus trying to, you know, half-ass put in a distance team together when you just don't have the time. So consider what constraints you have with family and the time and your job, and that can dictate which direction you're going to head with your dogs that way. And I think you can take a dog from either genre, be it distance or sprint, and try to convert them over to the other one. Depends kind of on their age and what races they've done in the past. But the time that you have to adequately train your dog team up, I think it's going to be tantamount and key. Secondly, it's just your finances that you can put forth to really bring your team forward as well. You can get caught up with it and have too many puppies and suddenly have too many dogs and you don't have any money left over to do anything else with but just to try to feed your dogs. And that's not the best thing either, fair to the dogs. So some wise planning comes into play there. And often you'll have dogs that are being sold by sprint kennels, and you're a distance guy. You're wondering, can I bring that dog into my kennel and can it do well? That takes some good thought and serious thought on whether we can convert an older sprint dog into a distance dog. I personally haven't had great luck with that, and I'm sure other mushers have had better luck than myself trying to take a sprint dog into a distance type scene. I've had very good luck with taking sprint puppies and then taking them into distance, and that they fall into my training regimen at a very young age, and they've never seen anything else. But their parents have been very proven in the speed mushing circuits, so that to me has worked well. And I know that the distance guys sometimes will sell dogs to the sprint guys too, not on the regular scale that we see the other way around. It seems to always be sprint guys selling dogs to distance people at a young age. That seems to work the best, at least in my exposure. And I'm sure there's many out there listening to this that could differ on that one and love to hear from them on that. How to decide on our dogs, you know, where they're at when they're in our training program. You may find dogs, if you're in a sprint program, that just can't find that speed that we want, the high-end speed. And those might very well be a distance dog that we need to place in a different kennel when they need to run 30 miles at 12 miles an hour versus 8 miles at 16 miles an hour, and they're happy. You can see that happy gait on a dog, and I think that just tells you all there is to say with where that dog should be. Can we make a 10-mile-an-hour dog into a 14-mile-an-hour dog? We can, you know, if they're genetically set up and we have the idea and wisdom of how to set our training schedule up to bring them forward. But again, there's a lot of people out there that have done this that are better versed than myself to try to explain that one. And I think I would seek out the input of people that have accomplished that to see what best way to do it. Would there be any questions specifically that you're thinking of?
Well, I'm kind of always concerned when I have a dog that doesn't really want to go anymore. I'm thinking to myself, have I not trained him adequately, or is this really all he's got? Yeah.
What do you mean by not wanting to go anymore?
He doesn't
want to leave the yard, or?
No. Like, they're dogging after 7 miles, and we still have 3 more to go.
Okay. And they're backing off.
It seems to be consistent.
They're backing off, or they're even.
How many times do I keep giving them?
Or before. I
replace them with another dog.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a difficult one. I think, number one, when we have a dog in a team that's not performing, we've got to make sure it's not a medical thing. I've been surprised over the years when I have a dog that's just not fulfilling where I think he should be or she should be, and I start to look at him and I find something wrong with him medically, be it an injury or something in that vein. You know, is there anything that could be inhibiting this dog physically that I could try to fix that might bring him forward? And if I'm convinced that's not the case and this dog is gassing out after a certain amount of time, we've got to decide if this dog is worth the time that we want to put into him to see if we can take him that extra 3 miles. Is it a young dog that's overextending themselves early? Is there anything we can change with our training schedule to make that happen? There isn't a clear-cut answer. You know, how many times do we try with that dog to take them forward? And if I'm convinced it's not a medical or an injury type thing, what else can I do to try to bring them past that point where he always shuts down? Some dogs at a certain point in a trail can always freak them out and they shut down. Sometimes you can find that they'll actually do that distance if we do a different trail because the interest is there. So I try a few different things before I kind of give up on a dog. because I think you can really, there's a lot of potential in dogs that we just let go because there are certain dogs that are much easier than others. And these ones like you're describing, maybe there's something else we could do to make them work as well as the other ones. Try a different trail, try a different harness, make sure, again, they don't have a physical ailment. See what your feeding schedule is, if that can influence that dog. How old is that dog? And so on. Boy, there's so many different things that can do that. When do you pull the plug on a dog, you know, in your team and find another home for him instead?
Well, this has been wonderful.
Doesn't help you much, does it?
Yeah, it's been
wonderful. It actually does, you know, because it brings to my mind.
Well, tell me about the dog you're speaking of. I mean, it must be one of your own.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wondering if and you know what? It's a Siberian, the one I'm personally thinking of, and I really want.
Do you have a Siberian and a Husky team?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be your difference right there. The speed's too much for him.
It most likely that's what it is. But I'm wondering, you know, but he's we're only talking 6 miles. But he does. I placed all season, so I mean, he hangs in there. He's just so strong. He's a great wheel.
And at the very end, he's just so hot.
But by the end, he's done. And I'm thinking, do I just put him back into the junior teams, or do I try and put him in my 7-dog team next year?
Yeah, how far are you going? Are these races?
I only raced 6 max.
Yeah. Let's see, that's why they have Sib races too. Where they have just races for Siberians because they're kind of geared differently. You know, Siberians make it through the Iditarod, but there's a reason why they haven't won the Iditarod. Is they just maintain a speed. And you can get them a sprint for a while, but then they tend to fall into what I call a conservation mode, where they kind of just pace it out.
And the other
sides are tough to sprint.
Yeah, but the other and that's what I'm thinking. Maybe he'd be better long distance. The other thing is you brought up a point, and I keep forgetting is the amount of energy this other Alaskan puts out before we even get out.
Mm-hmm.
He's so hyper. I think that he slows me down.
I've heard that argument before. You know, a calm team versus a hyper team at the beginning. I don't think they lose that much doing that at all. I think it's just energy and excitement on their part. I know what you're trying to say there. Are you losing a lot of steam there before you even get going, right? Like that. I don't care. It's really up. I think that's more of a personal preference of the musher than anything else, is how you want your team to look at the start. It's when they're pulling is when they're burning energy up, not when they're jumping up and down.
That's just getting ready.
Yeah.
That's just getting ready. That's not getting charged up.
Mine are minimal. I'm just kind of always thinking about that and how to.
Yeah. Try not to compare yourself to these other people that are being real successful. And successful is in the eye of the beholder, all right? Right. And if it's people that are winning that is really intriguing you versus that calm team at the start and that does it really, you know, seemingly professional, that gets you going, I mean, that's what you should aim for.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Tim. That was great. One more fantastic interview. I think that might be our last that we've got in the can, so we'll have to do some more. So make sure that if you have any questions for the vets, let us know, and Dr. Tim will answer that for us. So email us off to Tim@SledDogPodcast or Gina@SledDogPodcast, and we'll make sure that we get that answered and have it on the next show. Until then, thank you so much, and have a great day.
God bless you all.